in a variety of applications such as cryptography, where pseudorandomness might not be sufficient for security purposes. And it's natural to see if we can use some sort of device which takes advantage of quantum mechanics to generate random numbers, because we believe that in quantum mechanics we have fundamentally random processes. In the context of private randomness expansion, what we're trying to do is take an initial private seed and use some sort of quantum device to expand that into a longer private and random output. And what we mean by private is that it's uncorrelated with any third party, so an eavesdropper can't really get any information about the random numbers that we have. Now, in the device independent scenario, what we're trying to do is to develop a security proof for a protocol that will do this without making any assumptions about how our quantum devices are working. So we're going to avoid making any assumptions about how these devices work. So we're not going to make any assumptions about the Hilbert space or about the state or the operators that we're using to measure it. So this is in contrast to sort of traditional protocols, where, like, in a traditional entanglement-based quantum key distribution protocol, we might have two parties, Alice and Bob, getting entangled pairs from some untrusted source. And they extract random numbers by doing measurements in well-chosen bases on a random subset of these particles. So even though these particles could have been compromised by an eavesdropper, when they measure randomly on a random subset, it sort of takes away that eavesdropping advantage. But in the device-independent scenario, Alice and Bob furthermore can't trust the apparatus that they're using to measure their particles. So they don't know for sure that when they press a button on their machine to measure a quantity, they don't know for sure that the machine is really doing what they want it to do. So in this sense, device independence is really a relaxation of our traditional assumptions. The main thing we're going on, or hoping for, is that quantum mechanics is correct, which if it isn't, we probably have bigger problems to worry about anyway. So for example, for a traditional entanglement-based protocol like BB84, the security proof of this protocol relies on assuming that Alice and Bob are making measurements on a space which has dimension 2. But there's actually a separable state in a space of dimension 4, which will give Alice and Bob the exact correlations that they expect, but which will also leave the eavesdropper with an exact copy of the local states that Alice and Bob have. So in the device-independent scenario, this traditional protocol becomes insecure. So what we're trying to do is develop a device-independent security proof. And we're going to be using, in order to do this, we have to take advantage of non-local correlations. So correlations between measurements that can't be generated with a classical set of random data. Essentially, what we want to do is to use the violation of a Bell inequality as a sort of device-independent witness to having entanglement in our system. Because we know that when we have entanglement, we have this intrinsic source of randomness that an eavesdropper, no matter how clever she is, like, can't predict. So the setup is something like this. We can start with three parties, Alice, Bob, and Eve, who share some pure state rho. Alice and Bob share the reduced state rho AB. So we can represent, this represents Alice and Bob's devices. So let's say Alice has a box A, Bob has a box B. It takes input AB and gives us some output XY. And the system is fully characterized by the set of correlations PXY given AB. When Eve tries to attack this system, what she's doing is she's making a decomposition. So if she makes measurement E and gets some outcome Z with probability PZ, what she's doing is decomposing this and inducing a behavior on Alice and Bob's part of the system. So this is the induced behavior. And what Eve is trying to do is to maximize her guessing probability. So her guessing probability is just, sort of the best, if she can decompose this system into subsystems where she has better guessing probabilities for individual outcomes, then she'll know more about the string that Alice and Bob are outputting. So her guessing probability is this quantity for some given input. So what we want to do is, what Eve wants to do is optimize this quantity over all possible states, rho, and over all possible measurements that she can make. Her only constraints are that the sum of the induced behaviors has to add up to the original one, and that each of these induced behaviors has to be quantum. So there has to exist some state, rho, and some set of measurement operators. And some set of measurement operators, which will give us this set of correlations. So, just searching for the sort of, just trying to optimize over this entire space won't work well, because we basically have an infinitely large space over which to search. But in a 2008 result says that a set of correlations can be generated by quantum measurements if and only if it fulfills an infinite hierarchy of semi-definite programs. So a semi-definite program is just a linear optimization problem over the set of positive semi-definite matrices. So in the code that I wrote this summer, we just looked at the first level of this infinite hierarchy, which tells us that if a set of correlations P is quantum, then the matrix, this Hermitian matrix has to be positive semi-definite, where these matrices Q and R are generated by looking at Alice and Bob's marginals. So that's our semi-definite program. If Alice and Bob know that their system behaves according to some P, if their system behaves according to some P star, then they can input P star into this program and figure out what the eavesdropper's best possible strategy is. So they know the limit on how much Eve can actually know about the numbers that they're outputting. So say Alice and Bob have sourced their measuring devices from some manufacturer that they don't entirely trust. They can specify that these devices behave according to this behavior. In practice, they can't necessarily verify this with perfect precision, but what they can do is estimate the behavior by by putting in all the possible inputs and outputs, and then demand that the distance between this measured behavior and the behavior that they specify is less than some epsilon. So this is the variational distance, and it's just saying that they want the measured behavior and hopefully the ideal behavior to be distinguishable with probability epsilon. So they can choose some small epsilon, and we can go back to our semi-definite program and relax our decomposition constraint, and we just demand that the sum of the induced behaviors adds to within epsilon of P star. Okay, so now we have this semi-definite program, and we can use it to evaluate the security of some measurement scenario. The scenario that I looked at is called the Merman-Perez game. And the Merman-Perez game is interesting because it forbids the existence of certain input-output pairs. So in the Merman-Perez game, Alice and Bob share a state. That looks like this. And they also have a set of measurements that they're going to make on their part of the state. So I'll just fill in. So there's some grid here. And we're going to choose an input, AB, that, for example, 2 comma 3. And what's going to happen is Alice is going to make all the measurements along column 2 that are specified in this grid, which I haven't written out completely. And Bob is going to make all the measurements in row 3. This grid is set up so that the measurements in each row and column commute, and so that Alice's results always multiply to negative 1 and Bob's results always multiply to positive 1. It's easy to see that there's no classical assignment of variables, of values, that can fulfill those requirements. So what we can do is generate a correlation table for this. And I just have it on my computer. So it's really not that informative, but for example, for a given input and output scenario, we just have certain outcomes with probability 1/8, and other outcomes occur with probability 0. So one thing that I was interested in looking at, that we were interested in looking at, was to see if we could make a Laxa requirement in our system. So we know that our measurement scenario never permits certain outcomes. Originally, with our first version of the semi-definite program, what we're trying to do is to verify that the total set of correlations looks something like this immense table. But instead, what if we just made the requirement that that when we use our device, one of the forbidden outcomes never occurs? So instead of making this decomposition constraint, that this has to sum to something close to our perfect behavior, P star, we just say that for each of these induced behaviors, the probability that one of these forbidden outcomes occurs is very small. So it turns out that when we make this requirement, when we make this looser requirement, to the first level in the hierarchy, the security isn't really affected at all. So that's just sort of a cool thing that we can just, as long as we tell our manufacturer that we want a device which never outputs these outputs, then we know that we think that it's pretty much as secure as demanding that it fulfills this full set of correlations. So now we have a measurement scenario, and what we're going to do is construct a sort of generic security proof for this scenario. So we start with parameter estimation. So the general strategy here is, in the private randomness expansion scenario, we don't actually have two parties, Alice and Bob. We can just have one party, Alice, who controls both boxes A and B, and the boxes are separated, so they can't communicate. So what Alice is going to do is she doesn't have to sacrifice a lot of randomness in order to get her output. What she can do is, for most times, she can input some fixed input like 1, 1 into her boxes and record the output. But at random times, she's going to test the boxes with something randomly drawn from all possible inputs like 2, 3. As long as she tests a sufficient number of times, she can have a very strong guarantee that on the rest of these inputs, which are all 1, 1, the outputs were fairly random. So in the parameter estimation step, Alice is going to pick parameters K, P, and eta. So she's going to suppose that she receives a product system that looks like this. And then she's going to generate her input as follows. With probability 1 minus k, she's going to put some fixed A star, B star. With probability k, she's going to actually test the system by choosing a random input from the space of all possible inputs. And she needs to make sure that each of these random inputs occurs frequently enough. So if it occurs with frequency less than this quantity, can P over P just measures, just tells us that we've tested each input sufficiently enough times. If anything occurs with frequency less than this, then we'll abort. Otherwise, we'll keep on going. From these random inputs, Alice counts the number of forbidden outcomes. And if the number of forbidden outcomes is less than eta, then she keeps on going, otherwise she aborts. So this is our protocol, and what we really want, what we need for this to be secure, is we need that with high probability, this protocol abort on probability distributions which are far from the ideal that we want. So it turns out that we can use the sampling lemma to give us to quantify this level of security. The sampling lemma tells us about how far the estimate that we made is from our actual conditional distribution. So it turns out that this protocol is aborts except with probability epsilon on all distributions which are at least So if we consider the set of distributions which are at least eta far from our perfect P star, then on this set, our protocol aborts except with probability epsilon, where epsilon negative. So this is a constant factor. And what's important here is that T is just the number of tests that Alice made in the second step. So we see that the probability of basically having a failed protocol of outputting an insecure set of data, the probability of that happening is exponentially decreasing in the number of tests that she does. So this is a good sign, because if we just increase the number of tests, then this probability will go exponentially down. And it also turns out that if we look at what the semi-definite program is doing exactly, it turns out that what we're doing is also we're filtering out all subsystems which have high guessing probability. So for a P star distribution, we calculated some guessing probability that an eavesdropper could have had. And what this protocol does is it filters out all systems with guessing probability greater than this original one plus a constant factor times the parameter eta. So after the parameter estimation step, we can do our privacy amplification. So for what we're going to do in privacy amplification is we're going to take a partially secure key, some partially secure input about which our eavesdropper might hold quantum information, and we're going to apply a random hash function to it. And a result from the mid-2000s, I think, talks about privacy amplification in the quantum case, and it says that as long as our hash function is outputting to a space of size less than size 2 to the s, where s is the min entropy of the input, then our output is going to be secure. So the min entropy of our input is defined as the negative log base 2 of our opponent's guessing probability. So if we had a system, that gave the opponent a guessing probability of 1/4, and then we performed this parameter estimation protocol on a product system of size n, then our opponent's guessing probability is going to be 1/4 to the nth power. And the min entropy of this is a measure of how much uncertainty our opponent has about the data we've generated. And this is going to be 2n. So for example, if n equals 1, and our opponent has a guessing probability of 1/4, we can extract about 2 secure bits from the data that we've got. So we can use our information about the guessing probability that we've calculated to calculate the final length of a secure string that can be generated via a hash function.
So I'm sensing that maybe it's gone a bit fast so far. So I think maybe it would be helpful to go over conceptually the protocol again until the end of parameter estimation.
Okay.
I don't know if that's... I follow, but I'm sensing maybe it's going quite fast.
Okay. Sorry if I'm not being clear.
I mean, everyone should ask questions.
So in the parameter estimation step, what Alice is trying to do is to make sure that her system is, that the device she's using is close enough to what she's specified. So she's going to achieve this by randomly testing her device. So it's clear that Alice can't simply just test it n times and then be satisfied that it works, because the manufacturer could have made it to work well for the first large n number of times, and then it could just be working classically and deterministically from then on. So Alice always needs to continuously be testing the device to make sure that it's working, that these non-local correlations exist. So when she inputs, if she fully trusted the device and fully trusted that it was behaving according to how it's supposed to behave, she could just use the input, for example, 1/1, and she could just use it n times. And she could hope that her output was random. But since she doesn't know this for sure...
So if you have perfect correlations,
yeah.
It was good to say how much randomness do you get?
So if the correlations are perfect in the Merman-Perez game, you would be getting 3 bits every time you input that. So you would be getting 3 random bits out for each test. But since she knows that she has to test at random times, what she's going to do is so in this sequence of n constant inputs, she's going to insert a number of random tests. And she does this by flipping a biased coin, maybe, at step k. If it lands heads, then she's going to randomly test this device. And ultimately, if the number of forbidden outcomes that she counts is low, she can be fairly confident that the outputs here were also fairly good, because there's a probability, that the sampling lemma gives us. So the sampling lemma tells us how far her estimate should be from the actual conditional distribution. So as long as she makes enough of these tests and she verifies that there really aren't any forbidden outcomes occurring, she can be confident with high probability that in these cases, the forbidden outcomes also aren't occurring. So that's what Alice is doing in the parameter estimation step. And ultimately, the sampling lemma tells us that the probability that we still generate insecure output decreases exponentially in the number of random tests that she's doing. So once she's tested the system a large number of times and been satisfied that it's working as it should be, Alice goes to the privacy amplification step, which is just when she applies a random hash function to her partially insecure output because her opponent has a guessing probability that looks like this. So now she can apply a hash function to her partially insecure output and get a random string of length s, where s is about the min entropy, which is n log base 2 of the guessing probability. So this is the amount of randomness that she can safely extract from her system. So that was privacy amplification. And then in the last step of the protocol, so Alice is done with the protocol for now. She thinks she has a secure string. But we've been relying on the assumption that we're using a product state, this sort of structure. But one of the first attacks that Eve could have done was to, instead of hand Alice a product state, to hand her some sort of joint state in which when she tests at individual times, the probability distributions might not be identical and independently distributed. So at this point, what we can do is use something called the post-selection theorem. So the post-selection theorem says that a state that's permutation invariant can be obtained by measuring an IID state. So this is sort of the content of the post-selection theorem. It tells us that if we have something that's permutation invariant, for which when we change the order of the inputs, the outputs only change up to a relabeling, then this sort of state can be obtained by making a particular measurement on a state that is actually IID, that looks like a product state, for example. Furthermore, this measurement works with non-zero probability. So essentially what we're saying is that the probability of having a protocol which fails, which generates an insecure key on something that's permutation invariant, we're gonna say that this is permutation invariant, is bounded by the probability that this happens and that we make this measurement on an IID state tau. So far we've looked at states that are structured like tau, and this is just the probability that will generate an insecure key on tau divided by the probability that we make this measurement and we get sigma back. So we know that this numerator is exponential in the number of tests that we did. And So there's an exponential factor of k of n in here. And it turns out that this factor in the denominator introduces something that's polynomial in n. So ultimately, we can say that for large enough n, our protocol is also secure on distributions which aren't just product states on any sort of distribution. And this works because our protocol is basically permutation invariant. It really doesn't matter. Like, the steps of the protocol have a permutation symmetry. So because of that, it's generally secure on all possible inputs, not just on a product distribution. So what that means is, even though our devices might have memory of what inputs we've put in it so far, it really doesn't, as long as we make n large enough, it really doesn't matter as for the security of our ultimate output.
So this state you've written down here is strange. The state that's permutation invariant can be obtained by measuring an IO of these. Well, what is the first state?
It's a density operator.
So it sounds like that's saying, in order to construct a permutation invariant density operator, I can take an IO of these state and measure it.
Yeah.
So that's what you mean.
Yeah, it's a little more precise than that. It's like any I think it's any permutation invariant density operator can be obtained from the okay, so if you have this sort of permutation invariant density operator sigma, there's a purification of a Definity Hilbert Schmidt state that and a measurement of that purification, which will give, with non-negligible probability, which will give you back this original state sigma.
Right, so it's a probabilistic state. Yeah, it's more like any somehow. So if I measure an IID state, what do I get? I guess, actually, I just get a bunch of classical outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does it mean by measuring an IO?
So there's some measurement operator that we can apply.
Not an IID.
No, so this is, yeah, this is also imprecise.
The measurement operator acts on the whole IID.
Yeah, so the measurement operator is on the, like, so this is not precisely correct. This is, first of all, the convex combination of IID states, I think. And so there exists a measurement operator on the entire larger space that will give you back your permutation invariant state when you just look at the that part of it. I think. So we're just Yeah, so we're bounding the probability of failure by looking at the probability that we can make this measurement and get back our permutation invariant state. And then, so that means that we can just consider the probability of failing on these sort of IID states, which we've already done. So that sort of concludes the general structure of a device-independent protocol. And we're trying to see like what else we can do with a semi-definite program, because right now only the first level of the hierarchy is incorporated, but I'm basically done with getting it extended to the tripartite state, to the tripartite case where you have more than Alice and Bob involved. Maybe there's like a Carol or something. So. I'm doing right now.